Welcome to the Empowered Spirit Show. This is your host, Terry Ann Hyman. I'll explore the connection to the human spirit in a way that helps to navigate your life, including crisis. I am passionate about helping you to open up to your intuition and the metaphysical world of spirit to find your confidence and your own inner guidance. Take a pause, be inspired, learn ways to show up focused, centered, and more dynamic in your everyday life. Welcome back to the Empowered Spirit Show. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining me today. This episode is being brought to you by Forecast Salon, located in Homewood, Alabama. Forecast is a hair salon on a mission to shape a movement in the beauty industry, focusing on education, fashion, and creativity. Forecast strives to train stylists with the latest in education to provide their guests with the latest trends. Follow them on Instagram at Forecast Salon or find them online with their online store at ForecastSalon.com. And check out their latest in stylist innovation at Club Forecast Salon on Instagram. As this podcast goes to air, we're heading into the Great American Total Solar Eclipse on Monday. And as I've been talking about these past several weeks, eclipses are often times of revelation, as well as hidden secrets rising to light, and are reminiscent of the activity of the human psychological shadow. It is said that these current eclipses have similar energy to the eclipses of 2006. Where were you then? What was going on in your life? For me, I was deep in the midst of learning about spirituality and how it was helping me in my life, coming out of a divorce, taking care of myself, my children, and starting to help others develop this path of self-awareness. No surprises that I find myself deeper into this path, new teachers, new understanding, through letting go of old patterns and old wounds. I find myself raw and vulnerable, similar to the vulnerability I was feeling back then. Yet knowing and sensing big changes are on the horizon. Where are you right now on your path? Are you noticing what's going on? What are you involved with? What are you doing in your life? How are your emotions, your spiritual practice? And what do you keep telling yourself over and over and over? There is an accelerated period of high vibration. You are being given an opportunity through this eclipse to move forward and into a higher path. What does that mean for you? Ready to break free from the past? Eclipses are powerful teachers. They bring things to the surface so that they can be cleared away and something new can take root in your life. Do you need some guidance on how to make these changes, how to slow down, and how to bring in the messages of your soul? I have openings for my private mentoring Empowered Spirit program, a program where I help you repattern and learn tools and techniques to break free and create a new path to embody your body, mind, emotions, and spirit. Schedule a spiritual breakthrough call with me, and let's see what the number one thing is that you can do to break these old patterns. The link to schedule will be in the show notes. In today's episode, I have an enlightening conversation with Peter Coyote on the practice of Buddhism. His latest book is Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. The conversation is very open. We talk about what Buddhism is and isn't. We talk about politics. We talk religion. We even talk about the war in the Middle East. And we talk about what all this has to do with Buddhism. Before we begin, let's take a moment to pause and center and set an intention for moving through this eclipse energy. So wherever you are, if you can, close your eyes. Taking a nice deep inhale, breathing up the body. And as you exhale, bring the breath all the way down, slowing down. Taking another deep inhale, breathing up the body. And exhale, calling all your energy into you, grounding. taking another deep inhale, breathing up the body. And as you exhale, call in your spirit. Feel the alignment of the spiritual body right on top of the physical, the mental, the emotional bodies, aligning, centering. Taking another deep inhale, breathing up the body. And exhale, dropping right into the deepest part of your heart. Right into the very center. Feel that connection you have, your spirit and the greater spirit, source, creator, God. Know that you are loved, guided, protected. Feeling all this energy coming in for you as we call in the masters, the teachers, calling in the archangels for joy and love, calling in the crystal beings for amusement, magnification, calling in your higher self to receive the messages of your soul. Taking another deep inhale, breathing up the body. Exhaling all the way down as we take this moment to pause, to notice. Here we find ourselves in this new season of spring, as I teach in the direction of the east, where the sun rises each and every day, bringing that new inspiration. We call in these directions to the east, the south, the west, and the north, above you, below you, right into the very center, deep into your heart, setting an intention as you move through this portal of energy for the eclipse. Feel it, see it, know it, hear it, sense it. And allow the elevated emotions, how you want to feel, radiate out all around you, all through your aura, setting the energy. Taking another deep inhale and exhale, sending that breath all the way down, grounding, opening the heart, illuminating the third eye. And as you're ready, blinking the eyes back open, coming back. My guest today, Peter Coyote, is an award-winning actor, narrator, and Zen teacher. He is recognized for his acting in 160 films, including E.T., Outrageous Fortune, Bitter Moon, and Aaron Brockovich. His narration works include over 140 documentaries. He narrated the PBS series The Pacific Century, winning an Emmy Award, as well as 14 Ken Burns documentaries, including The Roosevelts, for which he won a second Emmy. In 2011, he was ordained as a Zen Buddhist priest, and in 2015 received transmissions from his teacher, making him an independent Zen teacher who has ordained his own priest. The author of several books, Sleeping Where I Fall, The Rain Man's Third Cure, Tongue of a Crow, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha, and the book we will talk about today, Zen in the Vernacular, published by Inner Traditions. He lives in Northern California with two dogs and tries to play his guitar an hour a day. So let us welcome Peter to the show. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to interview you. As I mentioned before we hit record, just been listening to you narrating Don Miguel's book, especially that voice of knowledge. So I do feel like I know you already. Thank you. Yeah. So before we jump into your new book, Zen in the Vernacular, I do want to kind of ask you first, like, what led you into the practice of Buddhism in the first place?
Sure. So when I was a young boy, my home life was pretty tumultuous, pretty dangerous. And I was growing up, you know, I was born in 1941. So World War II was ending and a lot of people were coming back and with PTSD, undiagnosed. People were drinking like fishes. There was a lot of violence in my home and outside homes. Nothing was like it was advertised to be on Father Knows Best. And by the time I was 14, I discovered the Beats. And these were adults who were kind of critical of the way the culture was going, the materialism, and all the kind of selfishness, kind of feeling of entitlement to use as much of the world as you wanted to, as if you didn't coexist with it, weren't made of it. And these were the first people that I read about that talked about Buddha and Buddhism. So I started reading books about Buddhism. I had no idea about meditating, but I just liked the ideas of it. And my good fortune was sometime later, maybe 10 years later, to meet Gary Snyder, who was kind of first among equals as a writer in the Beat period, but a deep ecological thinker, a deep spiritual man. And he was the first person that gave me an idea of what a spiritual life might actually look like. I mean, I was not so into Hindu Shvindu, and I was, you know, just, I was an American kid. And what I was really into was native culture. And when I started getting involved in the counterculture, I realized that the encyclopedias of how to live on this continent were Native Americans. So I started hunting them up and started sitting with people who I could talk to. That led me to peyote, a lot of mushrooms, peyote, old timers. We had some communes way in the backwoods, and we were kind of adopted by the Cutuk Indians up in Northern California. And sometime during that period, I went to see the Hopi, who were pretty much acknowledged as kind of the spiritual keepers of this continent. And I spent a month with this guy, David Menangi, who was a 91-year-old snake priest. And I'd been warned before I went that we couldn't spend the night in Haute Villa. No white people could spend the night. But he invited me and my buddy Running Deer into his house with my dog. So we stayed a month. And he told us the Hopi creation myths. Every morning he'd tell us stuff. And then he'd take us around and he'd show us where there were abandoned Hopi villages. And I couldn't figure out why he did that at first. But by the end of the month, I realized that he liked us. And he was telling us the last days were going to be upon us, when Spider Woman had the world wrapped in her web, which was electric wires, and when humans could fly, and when the trails were unsafe. That year, some young girl had been kidnapped, hitchhiking, had her hands cut off and left for dead. So all these things made a kind of sense. And he was showing us where people who were going to walk in spirit might live. But when I left, and I'm going back to the Hopi country next week, I go to the Bean Dance very often. It's the first of the Kachina cycle. But I realized that I was not going to be a Hopi. I was not going to be initiated into their deepest traditions and secrets and the real gravy of their spiritual knowledge. And when I thought about that, I realized that Buddhism was a world religion and that they had to take me. And because of that, I also felt that all religions and spiritual insights at their base had a deep transcendental core, that it didn't matter what door you entered through, it led you into the same big, vast room. So as luck would have it, when the counterculture kind of fell apart, or at least my part in it, I started going with a woman who I later married, who was a Zen student living at a monastery and practicing in San Francisco. And boy, I hated it at first. I really did. It was like, I'd been living 10 years doing exactly what I wanted, when I wanted. As far as I was concerned, I was already enlightened, and I was going to do this Zen for a little bit just to get polished up a little bit. And it actually turned me around, and I started to realize the utility of form and discipline and these exercises to get you outside of your small mind. And, you know, 50 years later, I'm still doing that. I also realized that, and I became ordained as a priest. My teacher asked me to go to this 3-year priest training. And I said, well, yeah, okay, but I'm never going to be a priest. It's not my deal. And I went there and I was so impressed by the people there. And I just wanted to up my game. So I came back and I ordained as a priest. And then about 5 years later, he transmitted me, which means he gives me the authority to ordain my own priests and teach independently of him. So one of the things that, I mean, I could go on for weeks about what I got from monastic practice and Zen Center. It was the most valuable change agency I'd ever been involved with. But as time went on, I also developed some difficulties with it. There was a kind of adherence to Japanese culture that always made me think it was going to feel foreign to Americans. And if I wanted to include Americans in the Buddha's teachings, I had to find a way to talk about it that would make sense to them, that would not feel exotic and goofy. And along with the Japanese, there were some difficulties about authoritarianism and hierarchy, which are handled quite well in Japanese culture, but Americans don't do very well with them. So I began searching around for a way to kind of ferret out a true American voice. And I think that's one of the things that Suzuki Roshi was doing, who's the Japanese man who came here and founded San Francisco Zen Center. He had a very informal style. Basically, people meditated, they did one little chant, then they worked and cleaned up the place. And I think he was leaving room to discover an American varietal. You know, you transplant the Japanese root, you transplant the French grape roots in California, and you get them started, and over time they develop their own varietals. It's a different terroir and it's a different deal. So that's what this book is about. This book is about trying to loosen the Japanese gift wrapping, not get rid of it, but loosen it to acquaint people more clearly with what the Buddha's gift is. The exotic Japanese practices and the fabulous Japanese aesthetic are Japanese expressions of it. And the Indians have their own expression. The Nepalese, the Vietnamese, the Thai. I mean, Buddha was not Japanese.
Well, I think you have some really big points there. Let me just stop you for a moment, because I mean, I think, you know, sometimes when we start thinking about religion, there are a lot of boundaries and borders and got to do it this way and got to do it that way. And, you know, I think that the idea of the pure teachings, I'm an interfaith minister of spiritual counseling. During 9/11, I took vows to help humanity, and I'm assuming you took vows as well. And
yes. And
the idea was to open up teaching spiritually, because I think spirituality pulls us in. It doesn't create all those boundaries. And so that's kind of where I come from. And that my study of Buddhism was the same thing. I helped a Buddhist Lama teacher in New York and traveled around and did a lot of the empowerments in Tara. And I'm actually a Reiki teacher, and see where that energy of Reiki from Japan comes from. So I think a lot of what you're saying is bringing it into the world is so very important.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I do too. The thing is, in every culture in the world has a deep spiritual tradition. And the spiritual tradition was transmitted to them and understood through their own culture and language. So if you go down to the Amazonian jungle, the people will tell it to you one way. And that's the way they know it. So, and they're adhering to that sacred instructions. And when you go to a traditional peyote meeting with native people, that, as far as they're concerned, that's their last chance. And they don't improvise. They don't fool around. I went with a bunch of hippie kids in a teepee and a bunch of Cato Indians, and I really saw the difference on this particular meeting, that in every tradition there is a way that you do it, and part of adhering to the rigidity of form is a way of disciplining your own ego, disciplining your own likes and dislikes. And so there's a great utility in that. But then you have to think, okay, so you mentioned the word vow. So the thing about vows is that they're always impossible. They're always larger than you can possibly do. And that's what holds you to it for the rest of your life. In Buddhism, we vow to save all beings. So when you first think about that, you say, well, how the hell am I going to do that? I'm not going to know everybody. But that vow is going to mean that moment by moment, each person, each instant, I'm trying to see how can I be useful? How can I be helpful? And if other people see that behavior and they like it, they will model it and they will carry it on. And that's how it's carried through time. So for me, it became important to find some expressions of Buddha's teachings that Americans could just intuitively understand, because there are tailors that have gotten enlightened at their sewing machine. There are women who've disappeared into their knitting or lace making or whatever, machinists who've disappeared, you know, had that little vacation from the self. And these are human states we're talking about. And, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, well, I want to get enlightened, and they think they're going to be in Buddhist Disneyland. They think it's going to be one blissful, you know, never changing LA sunny day. And it ain't about that. You know, we're made up. Yeah. So it seemed to me important. A lot of people, when they were meditating, were chasing the wrong thing, or they were looking for some state of mind outside their own state of mind, which the universe gave them. And so I thought, okay, I've been doing this 50 years. You know, I can be like an old uncle. I can steer them a little here and steer them a little there. And I also, Zen people, we don't have gurus. We say, don't put any head above your own. So yeah, our seniors, our teachers are like aunts and uncles who've been out there ahead of us. It's just like I worked with an American shaman woman, you know, who real deal, studied with Maria Sabina, studied in Mexico. And, you know, but she looks like a little Iowa housewife, and she's just as plain and simple as that, but she's really disciplined. She's really learned. She's really studied. And the fact that she's so American makes her accessible to a lot of people that would not go for woo-woo or Hindu Shvindu. So I think a lot of people, in their hunger to learn and develop, they mistake the accoutrements and the cultural overlays, the exoticism of Tibet, of India, of Nepal, of Vietnam, as the goods themselves. And that's not always the case.
I agree. I think sometimes when people come work with me, it's like, yeah, let me get the crystals. Let me get all the things, and not recognizing that, yeah, you know, dark night of the soul, here we come, you know, and I've been through many, and still, right? This last letting go of my parents, it's like, okay, you know, a little bit of realizing like, okay, well, who am I now? What am I trying to do? And it happens often. Right. But my thing with spirituality, and I've sat in Native America and I've done some of the Native American church. And, you know, to me, it is my practice. The sweat lodges, that is my medicine. I do believe that going back to the earth is part of my DNA. You know, it is. It's part of my family structure. But to me, it's like bringing us into our heart, bringing us back inside of ourselves. And I so agree with what you said about, like, don't put anybody above your head. I don't believe in gurus either. I believe we are our teachers. Yeah, sometimes we need guidance. So I can appreciate the idea of, like, coming home and really making it to where it is accessible, but recognizing we are going to break shit up. We are. Right? We're searching to understand ourselves. We've got to cut through the crap. We cannot live the way we're living anymore. We really can't. And just cutting through all of it, there's so much chaos in the world right now. So I know for myself, it's like coming back into that practice and helping people find the way to find that inner guidance, which is right there. We have what we need, but it's hard sometimes to get there. It really is. Yeah.
The Buddha taught four things, but the first thing he taught was called dependent origination. And what it meant was that nothing exists alone. You've never been independent of oxygen, of sunlight, of microbes in the soil that grow your food, of pollinating insects, of the people who wove that beautiful cloth, packed it, shipped it, grew your food, packed it, shipped it. And if you take it all the way out, the illusion is that you're over there and I'm over here. That's everyday reality. And it's true as far as it goes. Nobody's saying it isn't. But it's also true that we're all like ticks on the body of a dog. We're all part of one great big thing. And so because of that, Buddha pointed out to people that although we all have self-awareness, there's no tangible self like an organ. There's nothing that corresponds to an organ for the self. The self is just awareness. The ancient Chinese used to call it the host because it never goes. The guest is the body. It comes and goes. And so starting from that premise, he taught four things. This, when he achieved enlightenment and came back, as he was walking down the road, his friends saw him and they knew immediately that he was a different person. So he taught four things, and I'll just run through them quickly because they're useful. The first was called dukkha, D-U-K-K-A, and it means affliction. And he defined it. He said affliction is birth, it's death, it's physical pain, it's grief, it's longing, it's being stuck in a situation you don't want to be stuck in, and it's being prevented from being in a situation that you do want to be in. And he called it a noble truth. And the reason he called it a noble truth seems to me really important. If truth means anything, it means real. So he's saying, this is real. This is not a product. If you're suffering, it's not a product of your spiritual lack of development. This is, we all live like skinned people in a sandstorm. And that this affliction is what moves us. If we're too cold, we get closer to the fire. If we're too hot, we get farther away. If we want this, we go after it. But it's noble, which means worthy of respect and dignity. And that's the first one. And he's counseling that it's not your fault. It's outside of your ego. So the second one is called samudaya, and it means arising. And so when you're afflicted, thoughts, impulses, sensations arise. Somebody cuts you off in the car, you want to flip in the bird, or somebody's rude to you, you want to snap back. That's actually not your fault either. That's just like a byproduct. Bing, bing. Ping pong, yin and yang. Nothing you can do about that part. The third one is called nirodha. And this is where practice comes in. Nirodha really means a clay wall that peasants used to build around the fire pit to keep the flames of the fire, our passions, from leaking out and burning the village or burning the crops. And what the Buddha taught is that by meditating, you can learn that you can contain anything that arises. And the problems for people come from fleeing what's arising. That's how we get in trouble. We flee pain. We wind up in the wrong bed. We wind up over shopping. We wind up gambling. We wind up drinking. We wind up drugging, whatever. We don't live a dignified, helpful life. And then once you've learned that you can contain whatever comes up, and everything is going to come up because your inner nature, Buddha nature, is no different than the fundamental nature of the universe, which is half negative and half positive. So inside us is Hitler and Mother Teresa, is Torquemada and Obama. And what we do by paying attention and by taking responsibility for monitoring what comes up in us, is we own it all. We don't say we're the good guys. That's how we get in trouble. You wind up bombing a hotel in Iraq in the middle of the night and killing men, women, and children because you don't like the leader of that country. But a spiritual person knows that the whole universe is coming over their spinal telephone, and it's their job to not let the negative parts out past their lips or activating their muscles. And once you've practiced that for a while and have confidence, then the final fourth noble truth was called Marga, and it meant the path. And it meant the way of walking and modeling a Buddha's life, reflecting on right view, right speech, right livelihood, right intention, all of those things. And there's no Buddhist cops. So it's up to you to consult your deepest intuitions. Am I speaking about this the right way? Am I talking about this person, even Donald Trump? in a way which is not creating ignorance and anger and division. So that idea of not having a self, not having a fixed self, most all of us have been told who we are our whole lives, and we've assumed who we are by the way people respond to us, and we've implied who we are by the way people respond to us. And after a while, you get an idea that this self is a fixed body like an organ, and then you've lost your freedom because you say, oh, no, I'm not that kind of person, or no, I know myself. Well, if you know yourself, it means you know a little tiny, well-rounded person, half an inch in diameter, because the universe is boundaryless.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, I am you, you are me. And I didn't understand that concept until I left Birmingham. I was raised Southern Jewish tight community, and I didn't understand anything beyond those walls. But then when I left, I wound up in New York City and started learning. And then when I learned Reiki, I mean, that was one of the things we talk about with Reiki, like the whole grid of light. We are all the same. We are all connected. And that was huge for me. That broke through so many walls for me to be able to open up and understand.
Well, you know, 80% of the people in the monastery that I went to were Jews. My people are Jews. My people are Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews. And there's something about Jewish culture on the one hand, on the other hand, that investigative, deep thinking, looking, watching, surviving 5,700 years, that seems to work really well with Buddhist practice.
Interesting. Yeah, for sure. Well, I think it is important to have ways that we can understand these teachings. I mean, sometimes I feel like Buddhism doesn't necessarily have to be a religion, but the whole idea of mindfulness, and I think that was one of the things the Dalai Lama presented here in Birmingham when he came, that it is a way of life, and it's not going to take away from other religions, but we can approach some of the teachings and bring it into us to understand better who we are.
It's 100%. I mean, on many levels, Buddhism is not a religion. Buddha was not a god. He stressed over and over again he was a human, a normal human. There are sects of Buddhism which are faith-based, chanting the name of the Buddha over and over again, and they have practices, so it looks like a religion. But normally, Zen in particular, when we bow to Buddha, we are bowing to wisdom. We're not bowing to a man. When we are practicing, there's a point when you're being transmitted where they say your eyebrows are tangled with Buddha's eyebrows. You're seeing the same way. And so that's not a religion per se. But if I was in Birmingham and some nice little Christian lady asked me, do you believe in God? I would say, of course. Because I want her to trust me. I don't want to give her a lecture on, you know, well, do you believe that God exists outside of her creation? No, I don't, actually. I think God is her creation. But I don't need to give her a lecture. She wants to know, do I have something bigger than myself that I surrender to? And so, of course, I say yes. But if you ask me, I say Buddhism's not a religion.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think there is an openness. And I think part of my work is that idea of the spiritualness. And people ask me all the time, you know, well, you say you're a minister. Where's your church? Where's your temple? I don't have one. I work without those walls. And that's part of what I do, is to help people understand it is right here. And it is something that helped me many years ago and really empowered me to come forward in what I was going through. And I think it's important. And I think it's another way of looking at life. And right now, with so much struggle and chaos in the world, and it is hurting what's going on in the Middle East. And I feel it. And I don't really know how to talk about it, quite honestly. I do send prayers of love and light, but I don't know how to talk about it. I don't know how to present it.
It's very difficult.
It is.
But, you know, if somebody asked me, where's your church? I might say, do you ask a turtle where his house is?
Good answer. I'll have to remember that. Yeah.
That's a little gift. I have a little room, you know, where I meditate, and I ordained priests and did all that. But really, you're carrying it around with you. I'm carrying it around with me. So here's what I do about Palestine and Gaza and the Jews, which is so painful and so difficult. First thing, I've read a lot about it, and I've read enough to know that nobody has clean hands. Nobody. The Jew, the Irgun, the gang that became the IDF, was the third one. These guys practiced terrorism against the Arabs. The Arabs practiced terrorism against the Jews. You know, the Jews moved into their country. The Arabs are the Indians. We moved into this country, you know, and we wiped the people out. However, what I try to do is remember that every single person I meet is an expression of the universe. It's made by the universe. It has an unqualified right to its existence. It's made of the same stuff I am. I don't care if it's Donald Trump. So my job is to try to understand what circumstances and experiences they had that make them feel so differently. So mostly what I do is ask questions, you know, just ask questions. Did God fax a deed to Palestine? I mean, really, is that the way it is? But how about Native Americans? Yeah, I once met this guy, Khalil Mishal, who was the head of the armed wing of Hamas. I met him in Syria. I was there investigating something for Vanity Fair. And we talked for a long time. I told him right away I was a Jew. And he said, so what? And he pointed, there were 12 guys in the room. And he pointed to five of them. He said, they're all Jews. I don't have a problem with Jews. I have a problem with Zionists. I said, oh, okay, that's useful to remember. And then at one point I said to him, well, how come you just won't acknowledge Israel's right to exist? Mm-hmm. And he laughed. And he said, Peter, it sounds so fair, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does sound so fair. He said, that's because you don't understand it's a trick question. I said, okay, no, I don't. What's the trick question? He said, look, we know Israel's there. I mean, there's armies, they've got atom bombs. We could make treaties with them about ingress and egress and stamps and flags and taxes and tariffs and how the two of us relate. The only thing we can never say that they know is that they had a right to come take our land. What would Native Americans say if you went to them and said, we have a right to be here? So, I mean, that's a big leap for most Jews to look at. But I heard it and I thought, I've never heard that on the news. I've never heard that in any public discussion. So you're never going to get at the root of who did what first. There were always Jews and there were always Palestinians living together, but there was something about Zionism, and especially when you read this book about Palestine, 1936, the first Arab rebellion, you realize that it was when they realized that the Jews were going to take it all, at which Netanyahu finally admitted. But the early Zionists made a pact that they would tell their first world sponsors whatever they needed to hear, Britain and then America. Oh, no, it's going to be a two-state solution. We're going to work it out. But it was never the plan. And this Hamas invasion, this horrific invasion, occurred within a week of Netanyahu saying no two-state solution. So people were condemned to an outdoor prison. They can't leave. They can't do anything. There's no people on earth that could sustain that. So I just ask questions. Well, suppose you were forced to live in a little town and you couldn't enter or leave without permission. How would you feel? Or you couldn't get to a doctor. Do you feel that the Jews are better than the Palestinians? Or do you feel that the Palestinians are better than the Jews? Or is it a human question that people just have to learn that we're all here together? But I certainly can't lecture anybody about it.
Yeah, and I can't either, for sure. And I tend to stay away from those kind of conversations because I don't know where to go with it. And I don't understand. I don't understand why we have to inflict so much against each other. I really don't, you know, powers of control. I don't know. And yeah, it is not a happy topic for sure. And
it spices the pot.
Well, it does spice the pot. And I know you talk about these conversations in your book. And, you know, like, I think you've kind of answered in your way of talking about it. But what does this have to do with Buddhism? What does this have to do with the spiritual life?
Buddhism is concentrating on the relationship between people. And so is politics. Politics is about the relationships between people. And the relationships can span the spectrum from violence to deep understanding and intimacy. I think if you asked anybody, they would say that little children should not be murdered by bombs anywhere. You know, I think they would agree that women should not be raped and then murdered. I think they would say that all people at root have the spark we could call holy, the spark of life. And so how do we address that in other people, hold true to what we need, but share what was never ours to begin with? Nobody owned the earth. The idea of ownership is a Western European concept done by armed gangs that rode in and set up protection services, you know, done by male patriarchal societies that displaced the female earth-worshipping cultures of pre-5000 BC, which is the oldest religion on earth. The caves at Lascaux were the same religion all over the planet for 35,000 years. We know that. And we know that around 5000 BC, horsemen from the Mongolian far, far east came in, and goat herders from Libya and horse riders came in, and they were herding people, and they were tough puppies. They spent their lives raising meat, killing animals, eating animals, fighting against nature, and they translated that sense of domination to the cultures they took over, which were basically matriarchal and cooperative. So we've been living for 5,000 years in a kind of dog-eat-dog world, but it's not working. And now we have atom bombs. And if we don't get a hold of it, we're going to lose all of it. So,
yeah. I just saw Oppenheimer. Yeah.
Without one word mentioned about the Japanese. Without one word mentioned about what we did to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Just, wow, we made the thing work. And Oppenheimer and his girlfriend, and just that one hand on her head when she was drowning, because the scuttlebutt is that she was murdered by the CIA because she was a communist and they wanted to get rid of her. So all these things exist. Everything exists all the time.
It does exist. And let's bring it back to America with what we've done to the Native American. To me, that hurts too. And nobody talks about that. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, but it's being talked about more, but it's so covered up. And such a beautiful culture, such beautiful people. And my own ancestry comes back from there. So I am very sensitive to that. And it's hard to make those comparisons, yet it's still the same thing. We came and took land. We took what we thought was ours. How ridiculous, right? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, Peter.
Well, the root of it is thinking that self and other are different.
Let's just say that one more time.
The root of it is that the belief that self and other are different.
Self and other are different.
But here's an image. Imagine you're standing on a cliff and you're looking at an ocean that's filled with millions of choppy little waves, not big rollers, little individual peaks rising and falling, okay? Every one of those peaks could be a human life, an animal life, the life of a culture, the life of a mountain range, the life of anything that you could name. They come up into form for a while out of the formlessness of the ocean. They exist for a while and then they go back to the ocean. And when they're up as a little wave, we call them living. And when they go back as the ocean, we call them dying. But what those little waves forget and what we forget is that they have never for one second not been part of the ocean. And so we think that I'm in here and oxygen is out there. Oxygen is keeping me alive, instead of saying oxygen is my life. Water is my life. I have no separate existence from sunlight. I have no separate existence from pollen, from pollinating insects. So when you look at it that way, then all of a sudden you see things in a double way. You're not looking at just half of creation, because it's true that if I shoot myself, you don't fall down. So this guest is different than your guest. We have the same host. We have the same awareness. Every mammal has that awareness. But when we remember the other half as well, that we're also all connected, That means you have to take responsibility for how you treat everything, because everything is sacred, whether your little personality likes it or not. That's the tough part of being a spiritual person.
I agree.
Right speech. I remember once I was talking to a woman friend of mine who was the abbess of Green Gulch Monastery. And she's a really strong, powerful woman. I just love talking to her. And I was being amusing one day, and I was talking about some dipshit. I don't know. I just, an idiot. And I just got into entertaining her, you know, and just being a fool. And at a certain point, she was just sitting there. We were having tea together. She said, "Wow, that doesn't make me want to meet him." And it just slapped me straight up. Yeah. I just sacrificed all my spiritual practice to entertain her at his expense. It's a tough road, you know, to realize that everything is sacred and to try to treat it that way.
Yes, but we need it. We need more.
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah.
The way we treat our earth, the way we treat other people. Yeah. And I do like that.
We treat them because we think we're separate. We think we're separate from the earth. Native Americans, indigenous people know they're not separate from the earth, you know. And now I'm just reading about these new technological autocrats, you know, the Zuckerbergs and all these people. They're going to build their own cities somewhere. Oh, my God. I'm going to wonder how long is it before they're eating each other?
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a lot more than smarts to navigate this universe.
It does. It takes a lot more than smarts. And it does take compassion for each other. And I think just that idea that I am you and you are me, and we all share these feelings and these ideas that we are all sacred. And I do agree with that. And I think a lot of this does come from, you know, these teachings that you are presenting in your book and how to get it out into the world in a way that everybody can understand. That's one of the things about Reiki energy and the Dr. Yasui, who brought forth the principles. And it was from the foundation of Buddhism, but it was for the layman to understand so that we all can follow this in our everyday life and live to these principles to hold ourselves accountable.
Yeah.
We don't hold ourselves accountable. Who does, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they say that once you can internalize and make kindness a habit, that it operates as the force of habit, then you don't have to memorize any rules, because then you'll just instinctively do the right thing. But, you know, as my friend, I have a friend who's a great philanthropist, very wealthy guy, but he says, we're all just bozos on the bus. And it's a good thing to remember, you know. It's like, I don't care how much Zazen I've sat or all this stuff, I'm a bozo on the bus. And a Zen master who's not paying attention is just as stupid as a wino on the street.
Hello, I agree, yeah. Yeah, so in your practice of your Zen Buddhism, do you do the empowerments, do the Taras?
Well, I have a white Tara and I have a green Tara, but I don't do ceremonies with them in particular. Most of our work is based on meditation, on sitting Zazen. And then we have ceremony, we have rituals, like when people decide they want to be a Buddhist and they want to follow this path. The first level of that is called Jukai, and they sew a little Roksu. It looks like a little lobster bib, very complicated to sew. And it's a miniature model of a big priest's robe. I sewed my robe, it took a year to sew it. Anyway, so you have a ceremony where the people are introduced to the precepts and the vows, and they basically say that they want to be a Buddhist. And then if that deepens, they may be a garage mechanic, they may be a physicist, they may be something, but maybe they want to become a priest. So then there would be a course of training, and then there would be a ceremony for that. But the only ceremony, I do memorial ceremonies for people, like on the anniversary of their death, have a little black-edged card on the altar with their name on it. And there are little prayers and chants and gongs and chimes. And it's wiggy. I like doing it. Zen is pretty right here, right now, pretty down to earth. And not the reason it got all floral was because they couldn't make a living. You can't produce enlightenment on demand. And these guys were monks. They were begging. and the Shinto Buddhists and the guys that had all these wiggy chants and bells and chimes. They could put on a whole show for parishioners. And so the Zen people started to take some of those characteristics, because otherwise, how are you going to keep your temple afloat? How are you going to keep us in incense? So we don't do too much of that, but especially in the secular practice, which is what my practice is.
How interesting. Yeah. So as we come back around to your book, what is your hopes for your book? What is your mission with it?
Well, if it changes one person, if it opens somebody up, I'll be really happy. Buddhism's all around us. You sometimes see people in the streets with robes. You hear about them on New Age websites and this and that. But I still get people coming up to me and telling me Buddhists are atheists, or Buddhists don't believe in anything, or, and they just don't know. There's a lot of misinformation. And so I wanted to explain this in pretty simple truth, what the Buddha taught. And I also wanted to apply Buddhism to politics. You look at something like George Floyd, or you look at people, young black men being shot in the back. No white person's afraid when the cop pulls them over. They don't fear for their lives, but I don't know a black person that doesn't. So these are things we got to talk about. And in order for anything to change for black people, who are about 13% of the population, we got to get 37% of white people to go along. And unless they can see that we're in the same boat as humans, that we're all dying, they're not going to get off the dime, because there are so many built-in invisible privileges for white people, even poor white people. I don't care how poor you are. You've always got your whiteness in this culture. You feel like you can go anywhere you want. You can go into a store. You don't have to keep your hands in your pockets because people think you're stealing. You don't have to laugh all the time to relax white people. So any problem that we have in the culture is everybody's problem. So I'm hoping that people will start to look at it that way and think about all these political problems and all these things that are called politics are really just about lack of kindness, lack of empathy, lack of compassion, and thinking you're different than or better than other people. And you're just another bozo on the bus.
Just another bozo. But I like the way you also said about the relationships between people, because that is what's important.
Yeah, that's what it's about, And I mean, just look, like, we've advertised democracy to the world for 250 years. And it's been a progressive thing, right? Originally, democracy just stood for rich white planters, male rich white planters. And then women were folded into it. And then black people were folded into it. But right now, in front of our eyes, you see people actively undermining democracy, actively rigging the vote, actively preventing people from participating, actively talking about Vladimir Putin like a good guy. I saw some poor old white boy on the TV the other day. America could use a little dictatorship for a while. Well, that poor idiot has just never thought this thing through. Well, what about after a while and you want to get rid of him? How are you going to get rid of him? Or what about when he raises your taxes to give his rich friends a break? How are you going to feel then, Or he's going to decide that they don't need coal miners or machinists anymore. So
wake up.
Yeah, wake up.
Kindness is so important. It is. It is very important. And we need to remember that. And I appreciate your work. You have a lot of wisdom in there, Mr. Peter Coyote. You really do. So thank you for writing the book and putting your work out there, and your activism too. We need it. We need the causes. We need to remember.
Let me say something about activism. All right. I hate the word. The word was invented by my enemies. So if you want to separate somebody from the broad mass of people, you put an IST after their name. You call them a communist, a socialist, an environmentalist, an activist, an artist. And what it implies is that most people don't act on their beliefs at all, but a small radical subset that's different from you and me does. Well, I turn it around. And I say, if you don't act on your beliefs, you're a hypocrite. And any values that you hold that you don't put into action don't exist. They do not exist. You can rama-lama at your cocktail parties. You can have your wine tasting. You can do your barbecue. But if you're not acting on the Ten Commandments, if you're not acting on the Buddhist precepts, if you're not practicing those things, they don't exist. So I want people to see that and think about that. Because going to church for an hour on Sundays is not enough. For me, church is every day, 18 hours a day that I'm awake. If I want to be naughty and wig out, I'll do it in my dreams.
Amen. I agree. I hope.
So activism, it's like hippies. We never called ourselves hippies. That was made up to infantilize us. The same way they made up beatnik to infantilize the Beats, who were social critics, who were some of the greatest poets of the century. So there's all of this media that is owned by corporate America, which is only mandated to do one thing, make a profit for its shareholders. So the more they keep it stirred up, the more they tell you, oh my God, Trump might win, blah, 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 the more they're keeping your eyeballs in front of their sponsors. Wake up. You don't need most of it. You don't, you do not need air fresheners.
I do agree with you on that. I do. And I agree. Yeah. So where would you like me to send people to find your work, your books?
I have a website, which is petercoyote.com, www.petercoyote.com. They can find my books at Barnes & Noble, at Amazon. If they want to write to me about something, they can write to sfzencoyote@gmail.com. And that's, I keep that out of my kind of public, that's sort of a public email for spiritual questions. I have two Facebook pages. One is the Authentic Peter Coyote, which is because three or four people took my name. And then one is Author Peter Coyote. And I'm on Instagram sometimes as SF Zen Dog, like San Francisco Zen Dog. But, and then I have a whole year of Dharma Talks on YouTube under Hosho, H-O-S-H-O, which is my Buddhist name, Hosho Peter Coyote on YouTube. And that's what this book was based on. This book was based on weekly Dharma talks during the pandemic from March 2020 to March 2021. And then I transcribed them to give myself a chance to clean up mistakes and make myself a little smarter, because I just winged them off the top, you know, when we were doing it.
There you go. And a shout out to Inner Traditions Bear Company, their books and their publications. They're
oh,
really
yeah. And they've been great. I mean, I did another book for 40 years. I taught these classes with masks where I used improv exercises and kind of masks. And at a certain point, after I work with you half a day, if I put a mask on you and I hold a mirror up in front of it, you will glom onto the spirit of that mask and somebody will come out of you that you didn't know was there. And you have about 15 minutes of absolute freedom without self-consciousness, without shyness. And by the time you've done it three times with three different masks, well, then you're softened up to listen to my little talk about no fixed self. And so it was a way of like doing a lost leader for Buddhism that was real fun and real available for people. And Inner Traditions was the only one that would take my little book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. And so I gave them this second one, which I knew would be easier. And they're just great to work with.
That's great. That's awesome to know. Yeah. Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And as we go to close, I would like to leave our listeners with one uplifting thought. This work that you're doing right now with the Buddhist practice and getting it out into a more easy, accessible way, how can it empower the spirit right now?
Remember, you are the expression of your spirit. Body and spirit are not two. They're not one. It's a little bit of a conundrum. So I have a little practice, a simple practice. which is when you're confused about something or when you're uneasy or when you don't know what to do, just do a long, easy exhale through your nose and put all your concentration on it. Feel it coming out past your nostrils. And if you do that twice, your head will be completely empty. So that's what we call beginner's mind. That's like not knowing, not having any ideas. So I do that before I meet people. I do it before I pick up the phone. I do it when I'm troubled about something. And by doing that, it gets me back to ground level. It leaves me open for intuitions to come in, gets rid of all the chaff of ideas that are too rigid or wrong or something like that. And nobody knows you're doing it. We call it one breath moo. And then you are in your body and you're ready to go. Nobody knows you did it. And then the person you were angry at 10 minutes ago is a different person. So each breath is a new opportunity for a changed state.
Yeah, I agree. And that is actually my practice right now. That very bottom of the exhale. Yeah. Finding that release, finding that joy in my life right now. Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's why we're talking.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was really a lot of fun.
Yes, to your spirit.
Thanks.
Namaste. Yes, there are so many things to take away from this interview. We don't own the earth. I am you and you are me. We are all connected. Take responsibility and treat everyone and everything sacred. Make kindness a habit. You are the expression of your spirit. Don't be a bozo on the bus. All the links for Peter are in the show notes. Thanks again for listening. This is your host, Tari Ann Hyman. To your spirit, namaste. In the local area of Birmingham, come join me for my next Reiki 1 certification class at the Yoga Circle. You'll learn how to use Reiki to balance the body, mind, emotions, and spirit. It's definitely one of the most amazing self-care tools I have ever learned. The link to the class will be in the show notes.